Welcome to ACMN Conversations, where we love to chat with people who are making a real difference in the arts, entertainment and media industry. Today we've got a terrific guest, a photographer, politician, media personality, regular board member and mother. Heidi Victoria has had the most wonderful and varied career, showing us that your passion just cannot be ignored. Returning to photography after 12 years in the corporate world, Heidi has just released the most gorgeous photography book and exhibition to celebrate our industry and the people in it. People who are as resilient as they are creative, and the silver linings they found during the closure of the entertainment industry. It's titled The Show Must Go On, What the Performing Arts Were Doing When They Weren't Doing What We Know They Do. Heidi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Lyndall. Good to be with you.
So I think Heidi's career does speak for itself, but I do want to refresh our listeners' memory just a little bit. I wanted to touch on some of the highlights and set the scene for today's conversation. Heidi has served on many not-for-profit boards, such as the Make-A-Wish Foundation and the National Council of Women of Australia. She's a real people person. She's got terrific motivational and management skills, but I think above all, her warm nature and influential network is what really makes a difference to these organisations and her career. She's currently serving on the Stroke Association of Victoria, having experienced firsthand the impact of this disease. Heidi's exceptional parliamentary career has seen her hold the portfolios of Shadow Parliamentary Secretary for the Arts, Parliamentary Secretary to the Premier and assisting the Premier with the arts, not to mention Consumer Affairs and Women's Affairs. So her contribution to the arts in Victoria and Australia has been exceptional. That's not all there is to this incredible leader and operator. This is getting way too much from me, but it is a career worth highlighting. So we wanted to chat to Heidi about her career in politics, photography, women in the arts, and everything in between. So let's jump straight in. Heidi, you spent 14 years in politics. What led you to a career in that demanding yet fascinating world in the first place?
Well, it was actually 12 years in Parliament, but of course serving the community before that in lots of different, as you say, not-for-profit spaces. And it was such a privilege to serve the local electorate of Bayswater. But for me, the catalyst, and I've got to say I'm not a political animal and I've really stepped away from politics since having the career change 2 years ago. But for me, it was about standing up for the rights of my family. So I had found a public school that I wanted my daughter to go to, had moved house accordingly, and it had a fantastic bilingual language program. So it was Bayswater South Primary School. And so I moved from Blackburn to Bayswater to send her there and subsequently found out that, in fact, the government at the time had axed the program after 24-odd years. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because I've just paid all this stamp duty and all that sort of thing. And so I said to the principal at the time, what's the local MP doing? And she said to me, you know, he's tried. He's written to the minister and the minister has written back and said, no, we're axing all of these bilingual immersion programs. And there were a dozen or so, you know, running around the state where the kids actually come out bilingual by the time they're finished grade six. Like truly bilingual. So they learn it, you know, as I say, from an immersion point of view. And so she said to me, this is what he's written to the minister. This is what she's written back. And I said, he's not trying very hard. I said, are you happy for me to have a go? And she said, well, do you think you can make a difference? And I said, heck no, I'm a photographer. What do I know about, you know, standing on a platform? And I said, but I don't want to die not knowing if I could have made a difference. And as they say, the rest is history.
Isn't that fabulous? And so they reinstated the bilingual.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually been increased. So there are more schools doing it and they have more hours. They have something like 7 hours or 7.5 hours a week now in the alternate language.
That's amazing, isn't it? And please tell me that your daughter's now fluent. Please tell me she took that.
Well, look, the biggest thing for me is, and I'm a German speaker having an Austrian background, but I didn't learn it as a native speaker, whereas with the bilingual program actually teaches them to learn as a native speaker would. And the proudest moment for me was, you know, preparing her meal one night and she was in the bath and maybe in prep or grade one, and from down the hallway I hear, Mutti, And I thought, okay. So I said, yeah. She said, ich bin fertig, which means I'm finished. And I just stood in the kitchen and I cried.
Oh, it worked.
It worked. So, yes, she understands a heck of a lot. Her high school doesn't offer German, unfortunately. But, you know, that's the sort of thing you can't take away from a child. Once it's embedded in the way that the immersion program is, it will never leave them. She'll need a week or two in Austria or Germany. She'll pick it straight back up again.
Yeah, it's so good to get those little sponges soaking it up at such a young age, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's such a small world when we can travel. And, you know, it just opens lots of opportunities for kids of all persuasions. I mean, you know, Camberwell does French. There's all sorts of different languages that are taught. It's certainly not just all German. And those children will have a distinct commercial, opportunity in front of them that other kids won't if they're going to join a multinational company. So, yeah, it's impressive what it is that they can get out of the kids.
So then how did you end up over in the arts portfolio? How does that sort of move you into that sort of space once you actually then became a local MP? Yeah.
So I had trained as an artist. So I have a Bachelor of Arts in Fine Art Photography. When I was given the opportunity to be Parliamentary Secretary, well, Shadow Parliamentary Secretary, then when the Liberal government came into power in 2010, then I became Parliamentary Secretary. And then when the Premier changed, so from Ted Baillieu to Dennis Napthine, I remember the phone call very distinctly where, you know, Dennis rang me and he said, the arts. And I said, yes. And he said, how about it? And I said, yes. I could not think of a better honour to have bestowed upon me in my entire lifetime than to be the Minister for the Arts in this phenomenal state of the arts. You know, just what an amazing opportunity to do some good for an industry that, you know, I was qualified in and totally adore and absorbed in.
I think that is such a great lesson for our listeners about you kind of add your passion to your career and you really do feel like it's not work, it's you're just having a passion pursued in those kind of working hours. It's, yeah. It's,
80 hours a week.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's passion plus.
Yeah, so, you know, if I didn't love it, then it would have been the most horrendous time. But I've got to say, even at 80 hours a week and sometimes 3 or 4 hours sleep a night, I can honestly say when I was minister, there was never a bad day.
And as you say, what a state to do it in when we as consumers, not just people who work in the industry, but consumers of the arts, prioritise it so highly. So, yeah, it must be really rewarding. So this next question might be slightly challenging because I'm sure it's a list that's very long, but could you hero out maybe the most exciting or significant decision that you managed to influence in your role as arts minister?
Yes, you're right. There's a very, very long list. I suppose a couple that stand out and very timely too is the preservation of Collingwood Tech, which is opening this week as the grounds or Collingwood grounds or whatever they're calling it, but putting caveats on that so it could only ever be used as a contemporary arts precinct. And that for me was sparked by Melbourne Now, which was the precursor to Triennial, which of course is on at the moment and just the most amazing exhibition. So well done to Tony Elwood and his crew in there. But I think the one that has a very deep-seated pride for me is the Save the VCA campaign. So Victorian College of the Arts, although I never had the opportunity to go there, I went to what is now, you know, RMIT. The VCA, the fact that we are the arts capital and certainly the music theatre capital of Australia, we're the third largest, from what I'm led to believe, the third largest in ticket sales as far as music theatre goes in the world, behind New York and London, which surprises a lot of people. But, you know, when the theatres are full, that's the quantity of tickets we're selling. And it made no sense to me that the University of Melbourne had taken over the VCA grounds, which we'd enabled them to do via an Act of Parliament. It was a mutual decision. And then they decided to cut things like music theatre and puppetry and all sorts of phenomenal things. And I said, but if you cut music theatre after its first intake year, which was just incredible. People will go off, young people will go off and they'll train at WAPA or NIDA or, heaven forbid, overseas, and we'll lose them to the networks that they create over there. And so it was really vital for me that we kept the VCA music theatre course and all the other courses and gave the kids an opportunity to, you know, to train where they will work and to build the networks where they'll work. And so for me, it was a no-brainer, and I was, you know, an integral part of that. And we managed to come up with $24 million to award, if you like, to the VCA to help establish new ways of teaching, so making it viable, but also doing up the Grant Street Theatre and that type of thing. So really important. And then, of course, leading on from that, after 40-odd years of nobody being able to do it, between Dennis Knapfine and I, we managed to secure the old police stables on Dodd Street, which is now the visual arts section of the VCA. So the nice thing is, when I go to anything at the VCA or if I see any graduates of the music theatre program at the VCA, they still call me Mama Bear, which is really cute, and it's a title I'm really happy to wear.
Yeah, that's so fantastic. And pardon my ignorance, but did the VCA then get wrapped up in the Melbourne model of Melbourne University's approach to tertiary education?
So that was actually the beef at the time, was saying, if we have young people who are, for example, dancers, how can you possibly have them doing a five-year course instead of a three-year course? What's it going to give them that makes them more job ready to do breath subjects when you essentially need your body to be in tip-top shape to take them out of the industry for another 2 years? Was just not logical. And so that was actually what Save the VCA was about. Now, I believe that it has come into the Melbourne model for this year. But having said that, I actually had a really good look at it last year and got assurances from all the heads of departments that I knew in there who said, no, it's actually time and we're keeping it as 3 years. We're just offering the students more. And I said, well, if you're happy, I'm happy. So the Melbourne model is there now, but they've retained it as a three-year course rather than five, which is sensational.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a great, not even compromise, a meet in the middle, best of both worlds sort of solution. So good.
It took 10 years to get there, but yeah, they got there.
Yeah, isn't that great? Oh, wow. So you also spent some time as Minister for Women's Affairs, and at ACMN we are passionate about women in the arts. Yeah. What's your take on the current landscape of careers for women in the arts?
Wow, that's actually a really difficult question, because I think it depends on what discipline within the arts. So obviously there are lots of female photographers, but it has traditionally been a fairly male-dominated area. It doesn't mean that we haven't made our mark. And if you look at some of the great Australian and international photographers, they're women. And that goes right back, you know, for 100 years. But we are still less in numbers. Visual artists, obviously, you know, are quite dominant. But then you might look at, you know, other types of arts and go, okay, maybe we are underrepresented there. But I think that needs further analysis. And I don't know whether it's because they're not given the opportunity or whether they just don't have the desire to enter those particular realms at this point in time. So, look, I'm a true believer. Yes, there is a glass ceiling, and I denied it for many years. So I suppose I was certainly not naive, but I was wishing that there wasn't a glass ceiling. But I saw that firsthand a couple of times, and it was my job to go and smash through it, you know, without being vulgar or too manlike, and I'll probably get poo-pooed for that, but I didn't have to play a boy's game to be a woman in the industry. And so I think from my perspective, you know, if I was going to give advice to young women coming up, be true to yourself. Know what your capabilities are and go out and shine. Don't try and compete against men. Just compete against yourself.
I think that is just such good advice. And if there is one industry where you have a permission to be who you are, please, please let it be the arts.
And that's
where our women are thriving and being themselves and still, as you say, smashing that glass ceiling, which we are seeing certainly in musical theatre land, which is where we spend a lot of our time. We're definitely seeing some very talented, strong women coming up and smashing that glass ceiling. So
absolutely.
So what do you do in your kind of current, either personal or professional life, to further celebrate and promote women in business or women in the arts? Have you got anything kind of bubbling away in that space, or just something that you do for your own, I guess, satisfaction?
Yeah, yes and no. So yes, in that I'm with an organisation called IWF, which is the International Women's Forum, a very small group by world standards of about 6,000 women who are all high achievers and very acclaimed in their various industries. And I'm extremely proud to have been asked to join that organisation. Having said that, I'm not a browbeating feminist and never have been. I believe in being true, as I said before. So I don't think about it on a daily basis. It just kind of happens along, if you know what I mean. But I do, where I'm asked, help mentor young women. And when I'm approached, I'll always have that conversation, whether it be about arts or politics or, you know, community. It doesn't really matter. But I'm not in a position at the moment, because work is so busy, I'm not in a position to go out and start policy writing and that type of thing. So it's a different angle and it's a different part of my life right now.
Yeah. But I think that your value is be true to yourself, and that in itself is a reflection of being a woman. So whether you're being true to yourself or I'm being true to yourself or someone you're mentoring is, that in itself is a celebration of women and a opportunity to kind of give a woman or a female a leg up. So I think that's great advice. I love it.
Yeah. And I think trying to be true to yourself is very difficult sometimes for women. We all at some stage, that's a very big blanket statement, but I've never met a woman who has not at some stage suffered imposter syndrome. Me included, in a very big way, lots of times. But I think I've got to the stage now at 53 years old to say, you know what, there are things that I'm good at. Embrace them. There's also things I'm really not good at, and I acknowledge those. But I think, you know, again, that's probably the best thing we can do as women is say, but I am worthy. I am meant to be here. I am supposed to have success. It's okay.
Yeah, it's that. Old catchphrase, one of our team members brought this to the table when we were all doing great sort of motivational statements, and hers was, you are enough.
Yes, so, I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, simple, and it's really, really powerful. I want to talk now about kind of networking and kind of leveraging your networks. It sort of strikes me that in the role of a politician, you've got to be fully immersed in the community with which you serve. And that obviously comes very, very naturally to you. But I think as our communities kind of evolve and fragment, how do you leverage communities? How do you leverage networks when they're kind of they're very, very dispersed these days? Have you got any advice on that side of what I think you do so incredibly well?
Thank you. I'm a true believer that you just have to ask. So if you want to be part of a network, or you need to have access to a particular network for a particular reason, never gratuitously, and I have a beautiful circle of friends, and I don't necessarily need that to expand too much further. So if I reach out, it's because there's something I want to achieve, usually professionally. And so for me, I'm not afraid to reach out to my network and say, hey, does anybody know so-and-so, or does anybody know somebody in this particular industry? But also, if you want that to come back your way, you have to do that. You have to facilitate that the other way. So somebody I've been working with on a project rang me from Sydney the other day and said, look, I'm going to do this particular project in this particular field. I don't know anything about this. That wasn't actually the words he used. But he said, do you know anybody? I said, absolutely. When are you in Melbourne? And so we were booked in to meet with some people in the industry that I know next week, when he can pick their brains. And so it's, you know, it's, I suppose it's what goes round comes round.
Yeah.
If you help people connect, then when you reach out, they're very happy to do the same.
Yeah. And I think networkers, which sounds like such a harsh term, but people who do it well do it when they're with such a genuine spirit. And that give back is that genuine spirit with which to kind of have those connections. So, yeah, it's...
And as long as you never abuse that privilege of being somebody's go-to or going to them, as long as you're always, you know, gentle about it and don't overstep the mark, I think, you know, people are genuinely pleased to connect, you know, you with somebody else. And I certainly am. Yeah. You know, the world is about connection. Now, I'll give you an example. I was contacted by the Urban Economy Forum, which is based in Canada, part of the UN Habitat. And they said, we'd like you to come and speak on our international symposium last year. I thought, why the heck me? And they had been recommended. I'd been recommended by somebody else. I'm now on their steering committee. Now, I've never met any of these people face-to-face. Everything is on Zoom. Ideally, I would have been in Toronto last year. But they feel they have something to learn from me and my expertise. And goodness knows, I'm learning a whole heap more from them. And, you know, other opportunities will come out of that. But it's been fabulous to diversify. So take every opportunity as it comes.
Yeah, that's networking at its best too, isn't it, when it's completely two-directional.
Mm. Yes.
So now we'll get on to your photography because you've returned to your first love. What drew you back after all these years?
Well, the change in career a couple of years ago from Parliament after 12 years. You know, it was always my first love and it will remain my first love for my entire life. There was something magical the first time I saw what happened in a dark room. It was like Disneyland. I was still at school. Photography wasn't offered as a subject. You could do it as an elective, you know, when you were younger, but certainly not like the kids have opportunities now to learn that sort of discipline. And so during my HSC, I also sent myself to night school to try and put together a portfolio. So I was really keen to go off and get a qualification in it, but learn more. So having dabbled in corporate and community and obviously politics, the only thing I wanted to go back to, the only thing that feels like it's the right fit is my creative side. And it was suppressed for so long. You know, I got to work in the creative world as Minister for the Arts, but I couldn't do my own practice. And so picking up a camera was daunting, to say the least, and wondering if I would be good enough, that whole imposter syndrome again, because I hadn't picked up a camera for anything other than holidays for, you know, over 12 years. And totally upgraded all of my gear. Big plug to Nikon. Thank you for making it easy. The idiot-proof cameras now. And I've got to say, I have never felt so comfortable. And I can be working under the utmost pressure for, you know, 16, 18, sometimes even 20-hour days if I'm shooting a show. And I still love it. I still love it. And so the opportunity arose last year during COVID to discover more about my own practice as a visual artist rather than just accepting commissions and you know jobs from people. So I got out the little black book, the little networking, you know, book, and rang all of my friends in the performing arts and said, what are you doing? You know, because theatre's shut. What are you doing? And they told me and I went, fascinating. Can I photograph you? And so I started with my network, who then introduced me to other friends of theirs and said, well, hang on, you haven't got a comedian in there, you need so-and-so. And so it grew from the original idea of a 20-portrait mini exhibition reflecting what the performing arts were doing during COVID to 72 people. And eventually when we had the 5K lockdown, I was sort of, it came to a natural end, the project. So I thought, I better get this you know, edited and formatted into the coffee table book that it then was obviously becoming. And bless the Sofitel, Clive Scott over there is just the most phenomenal unsung hero of the arts here in Melbourne. And when I approached Clive sort of pre-mid-year and said, this is what I'm working on, can I have an exhibition, please? Because you are obviously the arts hotel. And he said, yes, I'd be delighted to host it. And so the show must go on. What the performing arts were doing when they weren't doing what we know they do, launched a month ago. And the book has gone gangbusters from its original print run. I've sold over half of the books in the space of 4 weeks. And I've got to say, from that has led lots of other opportunities. So I'm actually going to be showing at the Ballarat International Photo Biennale.
Excellent.
I know, which is very exciting. I've also just been offered, and I can't tell you how much pressure this is, that I've been offered another solo show, but it's to open just after Easter. I've got a four-week turnaround on a full one-woman show, which is really interesting. But I've diligently gone through eight external drives of archives and come up with what I think is probably quite a solid show.
Where will that be?
So I'll do lots of publicity about that when it's just about ready to open, so in about a month's time.
Yeah, fantastic. I was going to ask you about the experience of putting that gorgeous, gorgeous book together, and I have managed to see the exhibition, which I think is down now at the Sofitel.
No, it's actually running until the end of May.
Oh, it's still there. Well, I would urge everyone who's in town just to go and have a look at it, because it is just so gorgeous seeing those photos hanging there in Sophie's and upstairs on the 35th floor. And, yes, Clive is such a fabulous supporter of the arts, so it makes sense that you put it there. What were some of the highlights of who you got to work with in that book?
I got to work with very dear friends, which was, it's always a joy rather than meeting in foyers and, you know, having what we call Christmas kisses, which is, you know, all the benefits of Christmas without family arguments. And so I got to work with beautiful people like, you know, Bobby Fox and Rhonda Birchmore, and then up in Sydney, John Frost and Lyndon Terracini and, you know, gorgeous people like that. Of course, Sarah Morrison, who's starring in Come From Away at the moment, who is just divine, you know, and somebody's going to say, you left my name out of that list. But to work with them and then to see somebody like Chen Guo, you know, with Arco Kondo, who are the most popular ballet dancers with the Australian Ballet, you know, they're all over trams at the moment. But to see Cheng be able to leap into the air, you know, 6 feet plus high, what a phenomenal privilege to be able to be let into people's lives and their lounge rooms and their gardens and their, the idea was to not have them at work because most people couldn't work.
Yeah.
And to see, you know, beautiful Marina Pryor making her candles. She's obsessive about candles, which I am too. And she was making all of these divine candles. And Rhonda doing her wonderful mosaics, which she'd never had time to do because she was always busy and working. I see she's just done a weekend in Adelaide, you know, completely sold out. So just being able to peer in a semi-voyeuristic way into their lives, but for them to be willing participants. And then also to get people, to meet people that I'd never met, people like Andrew Swift, who, if you're not into country music, you may not know, but he's a two-time Golden Guitar winner, Melbourne boy, just the most delightful, just sweet-natured, driven, talented man, you know, and I would have never, our paths would have probably never crossed.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's those, I was saying, it's those networks again.
Yes, and again, thankfully, you know, people would say to me, but, you know, why don't you have so-and-so on your book? And I'd say, because I don't have their number. Let me just call them right now.
So maybe there's going to be a part two as we all emerge from this lockdown.
There was actually originally a part two when part one was conceived, and that was to then go around and photograph them all again when they were working.
Mm.
So have the homebody, and then have the person doing what they do, you know, when we do know what they're doing. But there's also a lot of people from behind the scenes. So, for example, somebody like Alex Duffy, who's the stage manager on Harry Potter, you know, not a household name, but an integral part of that show going on.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I loved the mix of people that you, faces that you knew and faces that you didn't know, or names that you've heard of but you didn't know their faces. Yeah. And that gorgeous insight into, yeah, another part of them that isn't just the performing or doing. It was lovely.
Exactly. I mean, the beautiful Connie Dyson, you know, a local lady who is head of hair, wigs and makeup on Potter, but I admired her. She's known to me as Lipstick Connie. She's the one who created the sparkly, gorgeous red lipstick on Callum Francis when he was Lola in Kinky Boots. So I went, you're the lady behind those lips. She chuckled and I went, I love you. Yeah. Because I love Ainsley and Callum. you know, as Aladdin, and then as Lola. And, you know, their photo is certainly in the collection, a standout for me, on a farm with a couple of horses. And I think the nice thing about the book is too, I've taken the images, but each sitter has contributed their own wording. And some of it's been 7 or 8 words. Yeah. Some of it's been, you know, their equivalent of War and Peace. Yeah. So whatever they wanted to say about COVID or what they were doing or what they weren't doing is there for people to read. It's a great insight into the industry when it was decimated.
That's the word I was going to use. It's a great insight. And, yeah, whether it was 2 words or a couple of paragraphs, it was really terrific. Stephen Curry, yeah. Particularly entertaining.
Oh, isn't he hysterical? His title for himself is Professional Pretender.
Yeah, I love
it. I love.
Yeah, so he's funny. Gone. Yeah. And I understand some of the proceeds of the book are being donated to Entertainment Assist.
I love what that organisation does, and they're so phenomenal and world-leading in their research into mental health in our industry. So, you know, yes, the suicide rates are much higher and attempted suicide rates are much higher in the performing arts industry. And we're talking everything from roadies through to superstars. And nobody had ever done the sort of studies that Entertainment Assist have commissioned. And so I guess my own challenge is when starting up my practice again was, do I need to supplement my income, all of that sort of thing, something that performing artists are questioning constantly. And so to be able to have an organisation with such a great reputation who were willing to put their money where their collective mouth were and say, we need to find out what's going on in people's heads and how do we then support them? How do we then support the industry? And I so wanted to help further their work. Yeah. So, yes, part proceeds, if somebody wants to buy a book, a shameless plug, www.heidivictoria.com.au or at the Sofitel from their reception desk. But I so want to, I so want to contribute to furthering their good work.
Yeah, they do. The research is incredible, and then the programs that have fallen out of it. We'll certainly be chatting to somebody associated with Entertainment Assist because ACMN do a lot of work with them too. So
yeah, brilliant.
What an organisation. So now another what's your favourite question. When you look at all the things that you get to photograph in the arts, you've done shows, you've done, you know, performers not performing. What is your favourite arts product to photograph? Orchestra, concert, musicals, people? What's
all of the above?
Yeah.
So I'm an environmental portraitist. So I like to photograph people not sitting still, not necessarily posing, although it could be, which obviously the show must go on is, but it's about telling a story. So, you know, whether it's shooting something like, you know, Saturday Night Fever or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Come From Away, I love, love, love working under theatre conditions. I love taking that pivotal moment and capturing it forever. It's such, I keep saying the word privilege, but it really is to be able to take what that performer is doing on stage and capturing it forever. You know, that non-recreatable moment. So that's wonderful. But I do love doing people studies, which is obviously where the show must go on,
yeah.
Comes into it. Oh, look, I'm just happy with a camera in my hand, Lyndall, quite honestly. I'll photograph just about anything. I did the decommissioning of an oil plant last year, which is really unusual for me to do buildings. And I had a ball doing that as well. You know, I was up and down on forklifts and it was great fun. So, yeah, as long as I've got a camera in my hand and a lens up to my eye, I'm a happy girl.
Yeah, and just underscores do something that you love really does.
Even if you get to 52 and you decide that really what was I doing for the rest of my life, follow the dream eventually.
Yeah, it's great advice. We just like to ask a handful more little questions, some of our favourite conversations questions. Now, this first one for you might be how long is a piece of string, but we do like to ask why does arts matter?
It's the backbone of society. It's everything. It's the fabric of society. And you can take away buildings, you can take, you know, they can be demolished in a war or anything like that. But without the arts, we actually don't know history. So if we hadn't have seen, for example, one of the exhibitions when I was minister was a wonderful one on Tutankhamun, and to look at the artistry in the chair of the boy king, because he was obviously so young when he became pharaoh, you see what people were doing, you know, all those thousands of years ago. And having been to Egypt a couple of years ago, the hieroglyphics telling the stories, but telling through pictures. So if we don't have our history captured, going right back to the Aboriginal, you know, cave painting, that sort of thing, we actually don't have a history. So the arts matter in everything that we do every single day.
Yeah, that's a really interesting take on it. I love it. It's that, yeah, it's our connections again. It's how we stay connected.
Yes.
And where did you discover your love of theatre and entertainment? Because I know you are quite passionate about the live performance world.
Yes. I was five. I feel like I should be on a couch now with, you know, Dr. Freud over the top of me. So, yes, I was five and I come from a very humble background, family. And so we certainly weren't involved in the arts because that was something that back then was quite unachievable. And I had a beautiful friend in prep whose parents were very cultured and took me to my first Swan Lake, to my first ballet. And I fell in love. I fell in love with seeing these beautiful ladies in white tulle skirts, you know, on the stage. And I fell in love with the music and sitting in the dark, being mesmerized and being, you know, by this lake and being totally immersed in the whole experience. And look, I believe that every child should have the opportunity not just to see ballet, but, you know, I know that my Charlie was, and she's 17 and a half and she's totally immersed in the arts and wants to be a lighting designer and she's a trumpeter and all of those sort of things. And, you know, her first major experience of sitting through an entire show was when she was two. And people looked at me as if to say, what on earth are you doing bringing a toddler and sitting her on your knee? She did not flinch. I couldn't take her eyes away from the stage. She clapped in all the right places. And I thought, you're my child.
Yeah.
I go, yeah, you got it. But, you know, she's been played music since she was in the womb. And I believe every child should have the opportunity to be exposed to and understand the arts of all different sorts. I don't care if it's a rock concert, but give them an opportunity to see somebody putting their heart and soul on the line for their benefit.
Yeah. And one lucky last question. I'll just jump back to career because it's been really fascinating to talk to you about your career. But if there's one thing you wish you had known at the beginning of your career, what would that have been?
Oh, crumbs.
Big one, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose that I could do it.
Yeah.
That I just needed to trust myself, my instincts and my knowledge, and that everything had led up from starting to volunteer in the community from when I was 13. Every second, every setback, every bit of progress led me to being capable to holding the position that I did.
A little bit of self-belief along the way. It's it's a real confidence booster, isn't it?
It is.
Well, Heidi, thank you so much for your time today. I think you've used the word privileged a bit, but we feel really privileged to have had some time with you. It's so insightful and such an interesting career, and it's a great lesson in networking and following your passion and being really, really genuine about it. So, I think there's a lot to learn from chatting with you. Thank you so much. So I'd love to make sure everyone knows where they can get a copy of your gorgeous book, Heidi. So I'm going to just reiterate, it's heidivictoria.com.au. So please jump on, grab yourself a copy. It's really insightful. It's a gorgeous book and the proceeds do go to Entertainment Assist. So if you can spare a few pennies, that would be a great way to support that cause and Heidi as well. Thank you, Heidi. It's been lovely to chat with you today.
A pleasure always, Lyndall. Lovely to see you and hear your voice.